You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
This is Julio Rodriguez, and this is the Lookout Landing Podcast.
Lookout Landing Podcast. Me llamo Matthew Robertson y estamos hablando de los Marineros de Seattle. What if I just did this whole episode in Spanish and didn't tell you guys?
I see someone else has been hitting the Duolingo hard in quarantine. Yeah.
That is incorrect. I did take a decent amount of Spanish in school. I think I got to Spanish 4 and then had to Google Translate to figure out the tenses there with estamos hablando. But I feel pretty good about that. I feel like that's what maybe these uncertain times are calling for, a dramatic mid-season character twist where I just start speaking Spanish.
Yeah.
The writers got really lazy.
Yeah, I'm just picturing like a trailer for this made-up show. They're like, the Mariners are playing a shortened season, and Matthew Robertson is learning Spanish? I'm making like a wacky face into the camera.
Excellent.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I'm Matthew. I speak English. That's Kate Prusser and John Troopin. They also work at Lookout Landing and watch the Seattle Mariners in exchange for grocery money. How are y'all feeling knowing that this season is already one-third done? We are 20 games in. Today is an off day, Thursday the 13th. And by playing 20 games, the Mariners have completed one-third of their season. Has that set in for you guys yet?
A little bit. I've honestly been enjoying it. I love the full length of the season, but I have really enjoyed this like weird like immediacy and like sort of the way that like, oh, suddenly are the Orioles and Tigers just going to make the playoffs?
And Marlins,
yeah. I have not enjoyed the, like, so are the Cardinals going to make the playoffs because they went 2-1? Like, that part less cool. But I don't know how you do it in reality in, you know, better years. But I have found the, like, immediacy of like a 60 game schedule. I would love to, you know, just have more sort of times like this where it feels like it's, you know, there's less like, oh well, it's just part of the journey, and more like, this matters. Oh god, okay, well, we have to win this because it's now or never. That's been fun, at least, albeit more on a league-wide scale, and you know, less the Mariners, where it's like, well, they don't really have to win this now. They could or they could not, and either way will be interesting in some way.
Yeah, the fact that we're at 20 games is so, like, the only teams who are at 20 games are us, San Francisco, they're 19-19. The Mets just hit 20 today. Atlanta's at 20 now. And then I think and Tampa Bay is at 20 now. But for a long time, the Mariners and the Giants were the only teams that had completed a certain number of games, because the West Division has been so far the most successful at keeping the COVID away. And I'm proud, I guess, of the fact that the people in the Mariners specifically, but also kind of our division as a whole, has taken this really seriously. And I admit I was really nervous about them going to California, specifically the Anaheim area, because that's like where Huntington Beach is, and those people have not been great about enforcing things. But, you know, it's been, I don't know if it's luck or if it is like actually following the rules. I would like to believe it's the latter. So I feel weirdly proud that we've completed 20 games, which is, again, complex in the, like, should they even be playing the games question. But so far, I've been pleased with how things seem to have gone along, unless we're just hearing about it. We're not hearing about, like, a ton of positive test cases that have happened from people who are personnel at the stadium and whatnot. And in that case, I think you'd have outbreaks seeping into the team. So it gives me a lot of hope that if people do follow protocols, like, that's what I think is most interesting about this bubble situation, like, with the NBA and everything, is, like, if you do follow the protocols and you do follow the rules and you do do what you're supposed to do, we really could get a lid on this thing. So
yeah,
I hope that this will be encouraging to everyone else that, like, hey, we could control this if we all just really agree to do what a bunch of actual dumbasses in MLB players can do. MLB players are not smart. They're not smarter than you or I. But they're following the rules. And so they're
dumber. Some of them are proving that.
I think they're very, yeah. So, I mean, Zach Plesac is probably not not actually included in this conversation. But, yeah, it works. So I hope that, you know, kind of America can take a cue from that in some ways. Like, okay, we can have these things come back, but you have to follow the rules.
Yeah, I do love the idea of, like, the Milwaukee Bucks, like, accidentally solving the COVID crisis, you know, like, the fact that, like, NBA is so, like, ahead of the curve in terms of controlling the virus is a very funny idea to me, but they keep killing it. And, like, baseball is doing basically the same thing, but just in a harder circumstance. Like, to create bubbles in all these hotels is, like, pretty difficult ask. Yeah. And we've seen that the Cleveland pitchers have decided that they're not going to follow the rules, which is terrible. Like, that's they gave them literally one thing to do, and they're like, no, I actually am gonna do the opposite of that. And then, like you mentioned, Kate, that Plesac guy, Zach Plesac, he needs to go. Like, that's
yeah,
because not only did he break the quarantine rules or whatever, like, he left the bubble to go just hang out with his boys, but then today on Thursday he posted a video of himself driving a car while filming himself.
Also,
like,
bad.
holding the phone, not mounted, holding a phone with one hand, driving with the other, half looking at the road in what looked like a downtown area with probably a lot of people. And he's like, yeah, so the funny thing is the media is wrong. I'm actually probably the safest guy I know. I'm great at following the rules. While he's, like, breaking three different laws at one time.
It's, I mean, it's amazing. What they've done that I think has been really good is, I think they've put the players at least the Mariners have done this. I don't know other ones, but they've put the players at, like, these big resort hotels. Like, in Anaheim, they stayed at one that was, like, I searched the geotag for it on Instagram and looked at all the pictures. It is, like, the most ridiculous Orange County thing ever. It looks like a scene out of The O.C. And all the people look like they were in The O.C. So it's just, like, this huge event space that, you know, has lots of stuff there. So maybe they're less, and it's a little more remote. So it's not like you're in a hotel in the city with all that temptation around. I did the same thing in Arlington. They were at, like, I think it was like a Four Seasons that was like 20 minutes outside of where this, it's in Irving, Texas, which, again, you're not beating down the doors to go hang out in Irving. I think it's interesting that the slip-ups we've seen have been in Chicago. So that seems to be, like, either the city itself is so it's such a temptress Chicago that people can't stay there, or, like, maybe they just didn't maybe there's no good alternative where they like have the land space to put them up in someplace that is more appealing than putting all your teammates at danger by going out to dinner, which I don't know. To me, that would be an easy choice, but
it's I think the thing that really has been, you know, encouraging is as you guys said, like when people have, you know, not to go, I mean, too thoroughly in depth on like how to handle the coronavirus, but like all these leagues have such a high level of testing and such quick turnaround on testing that between that and making people properly follow protocol and, you know, everyone generally having an understanding of if we do this, we get to keep getting paid, keep doing what we're doing,
and do
what you love. You know, I mean, yeah, but, you know, and it's like, that is encouraging, but that's also like, it is still a unique circumstance, right? Like, that isn't, you know, how quick you're getting a turnaround on tests elsewhere, you know, like, that's, it is both encouraging and frustrating, I think, because it's, you know, it's like, yeah, they are able to maintain this semi-bubble, semi-like, you know, screen, you know, bug tent kind of thing. But then it, you know, it's also like, well, if I go get a test, that'll probably be a week until I get my results back, as opposed to, you know, getting 6 tests in a row negative so you can get, you know, some Cardinals players back in 2 to 3 days, right? You know, it is good that this is how they're doing it for them. And that's, I think it's been nice to see that on the whole go reasonably well, but, you know, frustrating, I suppose, that that's not how it is necessarily, represented everywhere else.
The fact that they're all like kind of forced into this, like, I don't know, it seems like they're basically doing like, big travel ball again, which I'm sure like they all have that experience from before, but like if you like your teammates this season, you're gonna have a lot of fun, I would imagine, or maybe, you know, relative to what you can have in the world right now. Like if you're a guy who has like 2 or 3 friends on the team, I imagine that that's just all you're doing is like kicking it with them in the hotel. I imagine there's a lot of video games, and like if you're like one of those people who you're like, that's all I need, I don't, you know, I'm not tempted to go out in Chicago like police act, or like I'm not perilously horny and like swiping on Tinder the whole time, then you're gonna have a pretty solid setup. Like it's not
perilously horny.
I'm still waiting for that to come out. The Seahawks had a guy today who snuck a woman into the team hotel disguised as a Seahawk player, which I just want to say, like, congratulations. That's amazing. Like you might have lost out on an NFL career, but I will never forget you, person whose name I don't actually know. So we'll see. I would love to see, like, if the Mariners do that, I'd obviously be disappointed, but if they get creative, then, you know, hats off to them for sneaking a sexual partner into the hotel in a funny way. Like, I feel like with baseball too, you could do like, you know, in one of those giant bags that carries bats, you know, like something like that. Or like, you know, put 2 people in 1 jersey, disguise them as Dan Vogelbach. I don't know. I'm just coming up with ideas on the spot here. But a lot of these things are in play if the Mariners want to listen to me, which they shouldn't, obviously.
No, absolutely they should not.
Well, I guess one positive of this season is that we have not heard about any Mariners testing positive for coronavirus. That's probably the biggest positive we can have, but we are actually gathered to discuss the positives on the field as well as some negatives, which there are a few, but it's always better to start with the happy. We used to call this exercise of like naming one thing that was positive, one thing that was negative. We used to call this happy crappy in this youth group I went to. Non-church affiliated youth group. We were a cool youth group. It was mostly about the endless horrors of using drugs and alcohol, and then cut to 12 years later when alcohol outnumbers vegetables in my fridge about 16 to 1. But yes, there's a lot of parallels here between this youth group that I went to and the 2020 Mariners season. But I know you guys probably
all
have
of
some
them
thoughts.
Happening in a basement. Whoa!
It wasn't quite a basement. It was a spare room in the local firehouse.
All right,
they let us use.
Let my joke live. Okay, that was clever. Don't fact check.
It
the
was
jokes.
A clever joke. I was yes anding you.
Not
that was no anding.
I mean, Matthew is the improv expert here, so.
No, I actually have a deep, deep aversion to improv comedy. It makes me very uncomfortable. I don't know why. Something about it that
I
genuinely find unsettling. Then I guess let's get into it. I kind of just wanted to cover all of the positives to make people as happy as possible. And I assume that we all kind of have the same thoughts. But one thing that I wanted to start with, one thing that I personally am happy about, is being right. That's correct, folks. I'm taking the concept of being correct, because in several season preview episodes and articles on the website, even dating back to like the winter before the virus, we kept saying that the Mariners were going to have a lot of games where the starter does their job, the young offense does enough to get a lead, and then the bullpen kind of, you know, takes a look at that creation and sprays it with a hose filled with fireball, and the whole thing goes to shit. I think at some point I actually said, like, prepare yourself for a lot of 8-5 losses. And that has already happened several times over. Like, mm-hmm. Last night was 7-4 to the Rangers. They lost 8-4 to the Rockies. There was an 8-2 and a 7-2 against the Astros. One game against the Astros actually did end 8-5. And I feel very happy about this, not only because of the validation, but also because this is basically ideal for the Mariners, which we've discussed. Like, the draft pick that will come from losing is worth so much more than whatever F war this bullpen accumulates. And most importantly, this current bullpen doesn't really have any guys they'll be relying on when the contention window arrives. So for me, this season is going exactly according to plan, and I'm pretty happy about that, honestly.
Yeah, the happiness is no doubt at least in part due to the hose of fireball that you had installed, which in addition to your fridge, really, I've been meaning to talk to you about it. The ratio is a little out of whack there, but you know, it's your apartment. You're welcome to do as you wish. I do fully agree with how how a lot of these games have been playing out. Yes, it's frustrating to watch games get blown, but it's so much more satisfying. Kate, I would love to hear you sort of expand on this, because this was, the most recent game, but like, it's so much less upsetting in a season where we're not expecting much, as a caveat, to have the games be lost because of guys who we will probably, we may forget on a Sporkle quiz, in a year or two, as opposed to, because the main guys who we want to see succeeding, for the most part, aren't having success.
Yeah, for sure. I would say, like, Joey Gerber. I care about how Joey Gerber does, because he is one of the only pieces looking forward who I see, like, could still be in the bullpen next year, the season after, etc. Other than that, yeah, it feels like a lot of guys who are getting some looks to possibly be trade candidates, and they must all love the Mariners so much because they just go out there and blow it. They take turns blowing it too. I mean, that to me, that is also satisfying, is that it's not like just one person I can heap all my disparagement upon, but it's the bullpen roulette, and you're like, who's it gonna be? It's like a little mini game within the game. And then if that person's Eric Swanson, it's like, which Eric Swanson is it going to be? Because there's like a version of him that's really, really good, and there's a version of him that's terrible. And either one could show up on any given night. So, I mean, to me, that's exciting too. Like, is this going to be the Swanson who hits 97, paints it on the black, or is this going to be Eric Swanson serving up some Midwest-style meatballs? Who knows? And I just... I mean, to me, I was surprised because last night after Texas, after the loss to Texas, yes, it was disappointing. I mean, Taiwan pitched well. They got a lead. They really jumped on Texas early. And they probably didn't do enough in later innings. You know, the offense wasn't perfect. But then the bullpen came in and did what, you know the bullpen's going to do. And people were so mad about it on Twitter. I was like, why you have to be mad? Like, they didn't need to be mad about it. I didn't feel mad, at least. Like, to me, it was kind of the perfect loss. It was, again, like, I think Eric Swanson might still be good. I'm okay with being on the journey of him as he, like, figures out whatever it is he's going to be. I don't really care. And it's just really hard for me to get worked up about any kind of loss this year, specifically because of where they're positioned. And also because it always comes back to, I don't care how bad the baseball is. I'm so glad to be watching baseball.
Yeah, that's exactly where I am. And I think it is really fun in a perverse sort of way to watch. It's literally like a movie that you don't know how it's going to end, because while we know the characters a lot of the times, I mean, there's some that I don't know. Like, I'm still kind of learning the Misheviches and the Taylor Williams or whatever. But, like, watching them decide, okay, you're getting the seventh inning, and, like, you could, like you said, Kate, either go 1-2-3 or give up 4 runs. Like, that is kind of fun to watch. If you can allow yourself to not care about the win or loss, because I know that's hard for a lot of people. Yeah. But for me, I have a great time just watching them figure shit out, like you said. Yeah. Like, it's really cool to see a bunch of guys, like, who probably also, if we're being realistic, didn't expect to be here. Like, there's a lot of guys who, for a lot of other organizations, would not be in the big leagues. So they get to, like, live out their dream and, in a, you know, backhanded kind of way, help the Mariners every time they blow a game. Like, it's very noble of them to come up, give up, like, 8 runs after the 7th inning and get Kumar Rocker one step closer to Seattle. That's as much as you can help the Mariners right
now.
That's
hero. That's heroism. That's not all heroes wear capes. Some wear Mariners uniform numbers that start in, like, the 60s.
Yeah.
Misheves is an interesting... So I was watching the Mets game today with the New York Mets commentary, which, to me, listening to any other commentary, except the Chicago announcers, I love the White Sox announcers, but... it's just such a tour around of appreciation for me for Dave Sims and Brick Riz and Goldsmith and Blowers, especially Mike Blowers. Like, it's just such a better broadcast booth than a lot of places have. But anyway, the Mets announcers were facing Seth Romero, who is a Nationals prospect who has not pitched above A-ball. He's had a bunch of off the field trouble. This poor kid is up here. He's messing up. But he also had, like, moments of brilliance. And I was like, man. And he had this huge, stupid smile on his face while he was, like, struggling. After he finally, like, struck a guy out and his day came to an end. He just looked like the happiest guy in the world. The Mets announcers were like, yeah, there's so many people up here who don't deserve to be here. Like, they shouldn't be here, or something like that. And I was like, what a horrible way to approach this weird little season where, like, tons of guys are getting exposure that, yeah, they wouldn't normally get because their teams need them because COVID, or because, you know, they just want to give them run and see how they could do. No, Evan White should probably have had time in AAA to refine his plate approach against the away stuff that he's getting constantly victimized on, but he didn't get that. So now he's here and we all have to make the best of it. And, like, I don't know, why not just celebrate the joys as they come? I'm a very zen baseball fan this year, which is, it's nice. It's exciting, I think, to just kind of try to turn up the good.
Yeah, that's always the beauty of rooting for a bad team, which obviously we have a lot of experience in. It's like, it does reach that point, and for this season, it was kind of right from the beginning where you're like, yeah, whatever, man. Like, especially now, because you're like, I just want to watch baseball. So anything that happens is cool with me. But to see, like, just a kind of general laissez-faire approach to everything, like, I feel like even Scott Service is just like, he doesn't really seem to have much of, like, a stringent bullpen plan. It's more of like, whatever I'm feeling today, go with the flow kind of thing.
Roll the dice. I will say, yeah, like,
and that's cool with me.
Anthony Mishevitz, it matters a lot to him. You can see that dude is the sweatiest dude I've ever seen. He is just immediately drenched upon taking one foot onto the field. Like, I don't know if that's just like how he is or what, but he is just watch him sometime and you will see, like, the man is glistening like a Christmas ham at all times. He's thrown one pitch and he looks like he's run a marathon. I love it. It matters to him. Like, I'm rooting for him. I'm also, you know, not exactly rooting. I'm not exactly not rooting against him, I would say that way. Like, what happens, happens. But,
yeah,
you know, I want them to be successful. If they're not successful, it's pretty easy to, like, just kind of, next time.
Kate, you also had a great topical nickname for Mishevitz. I don't know if you're willing to share that with our listeners.
I did?
Yeah, I believe you referred to him as the wet-ass pitcher.
Yes, I did call him a wet-ass pitcher. Yes, he is our WAP. Nobody, everybody
team,
tell
every
Hunter
team deserves
Bishop
one
that's
WAP.
What that means.
At least one. Yeah.
Yes.
We got a question that's kind of about this, which is actually, I think, an interesting
about
take
what
on
WAP
it
is,
from...
because I'm still not entirely sure.
No, that is a different podcast entirely. the question is about the bullpen, and it came from Patrick J. Burke 84 on Twitter. Thank you, Patrick. They said, when does the complete disregard of investment in the bullpen become irresponsible in terms of the development of young players? Wouldn't it be more advantageous to see prospects getting more meaningful / stressful live reps late in games? Better pen equals better competition. This is, I will admit, not something that I had considered, but it is kind of interesting. I mean, I think for Major League Baseball players, even if they're more of a AAA guy, like we said, like, there's a lot of fringe here. But I think that for them, like, baseball is baseball. I don't really think that they're up there thinking, like, oh, well, this guy is, you know, more of a AA pitcher, so I'm going to, you know, I'm going to take my foot off the gas a little bit. Like, if you're playing a baseball game, you're just trying to beat the guy in front of you. Like, if you're in the field behind a shitty pitcher, obviously that sucks. But I don't think that that's going to make, like, Kyle Lewis sour on the Mariners organization, you know? I think he's probably going to be impatient at certain points, as anyone is who's played behind a shitty pitcher, but I don't think it's, like, actually damaging or irresponsible.
Yeah, didn't we have that
especially
one
because
still...
there's no need for a bullpen.
Didn't we have a still of Shed Long looking, like, just completely... I want to say nonplussed, but that's not the right definition. Like... he just looked maybe discouraged, but more disgusted. I think disgusted would be fair as he was looking at the mound, and I forget who he was even looking at. I'll just say it was Brian Shaw.
I believe
Shaw.
This was a post-Brian Shaw, as Brian Shaw was being removed.
If there's somebody
the game,
that we're
yes.
going to be kicking, it's probably Brian Shaw. And if there's someone who's not enjoyable for me to watch because I don't care to see him figure it out, it's Brian yeah. Shaw. I have no investment in him. Sorry, no. Dude.
I will say, I think there is something to this point in the sense that you do want your players playing sort of high intensity, high leverage reps as much as possible because, you know, yes, it's valuable to have you know, challenges and play against top level competition. But, you know, granted, the Mariners don't have like Justin Verlander in their camp, but like the Mariners have enough major league quality pitchers, or they can string together enough, you know, relievers where it's like they could make these guys see mid to upper 90s with good sliders, good breaking balls every day if they wanted. So the impactful part of this is giving them the opportunities to have those sort of high stress, high pressure situations. And I do think you miss out on that a little bit, but I think the bullpen kind of comes and goes on that. You know, last night, for instance, they got a few extra, you know, high stress, plate appearances or close game high, you know, plate appearances because the bullpen blew it. So, you know, I think that's a case in a sense, but I would put that more across the board on making these guys play for what is not a fully fleshed out team, which the trade-off there is you have enough guys that you need to get playing time to see if they're going to eventually become parts of a play, you know, fully fleshed out team. So I think, you know, if that's still the issue next year and the year after, you absolutely are in a significant issue. We, you know, we kind of saw that from 2010 to 2013, where it was like you had a ton of guys who didn't really get that much better, didn't really have that much development, never were playing sort of pertinent games, and you know, that's not a great situation. But right now, I don't think that's, you know, I think so many of them are new enough to the game that, or to the bigs, that it's not sort of limiting them too much.
I would also say, and John, you as a player can correct me on this, but it feels like there's a little bit of a different relationship between your position players and your starter versus your position players and your bullpen.
Yeah, it's a definitely, you know, it is a different vibe where it's like, this is Taiwan's game.
Yeah, we don't want to mess up Taiwan. We want to help Taiwan win Taiwan's game. Like, right. Yeah.
You know, and I think, I mean, especially in a shortened season like this, like, the entire goal is to make sure that every player is prioritizing every plate appearance, every opportunity they get, because they're not going to get nearly as many as they would in any other season at the big league level or otherwise. So, you know, if you are having a difficult time getting guys to focus, treat it with intensity, that's, you know, that's kind of a coaching issue. And not to say that that has been an issue, just saying, like, it should be clear that this is impactful right now.
Yeah, I do like that angle you mentioned too, John, of, like, the relievers blowing a game late, making for more impactful plate appearances. Like, if they're up 7-3 and then it becomes 8-7, like, all of a sudden those at-bats that they have while down 8-7 are much more important. And I think that's great. So yeah, I think that the bullpen and the hitters can kind of form a bond here this season, because if the hitters get an early lead, oh, the bullpen loves that. And then if the bullpen gives it right back, oh, cool, the hitters have intense at-bats that give them useful experience against big league closers. So that's great for everyone. And I think that, to answer Patrick's question, I think that it's actually very responsible as opposed to irresponsible to just have a garbage bullpen this year. But thank you nonetheless, Patrick, for your question, because I genuinely had not thought about what the mental aspect of the shitty bullpen would be. So thank you.
I think there is a potential negative feedback loop of, if it continues to be that your team is getting your games blown, that can be dispiriting. So in some way you do want to have, like, some degree of competency, but I don't think we're there yet, and I don't think we'll get there in an only 60 games of a season.
Yeah. Should we talk about J.P. Crawford being incredible? He leads all American League shortstops in on-base percentage right now, because Carlos Correa does not count, I've decided. So, J.P., congratulations. You're leading the American League in on-base percentage for shortstops. He has been a revelation. I think we all knew that he could be good, but to see it all happen so quickly has been a surprise for me. Like, he's kind of doing what Kyle Lewis did last season, where it's just so much good in such a dense amount of time that it's kind of overwhelming. And Crawford is doing it on defense as well. He's had, you know, a couple errant throws here and there, but overall I think he's been better than advertised, which is great. I mean, I know you guys have been watching the same player and you feel the same way. I'm trying to think of an interesting way to package this information, but he's certainly one of my positives so far, if not the number one positive on the whole team.
Yeah, I've been super pleasantly surprised. I think I tweeted last night that JP, one of my ongoing bits for this season, in addition to Dylan Moore breaking physics, is JP figuring out different things JP can stand for. So my latest decision is that JP stands for just Pacific, as in just Pacific time, because he's, like, just a super Cali kid, you know? He, like, loves his revolution and He's very vibey. I feel like J.P. Crawford is someone who performs vibe checks on a fairly regular basis. Tell me I'm wrong. You're not wrong at all. Yeah. You know, he definitely has some crystals, like some house plants. You know, he's just, he lives that lifestyle, I think. And this is much more amenable to him to be in Seattle and be on this particular team than I think being in Philadelphia, which I've lived in and can say from firsthand experience, it sucks your joy away. It just sucks your lifeblood right out of you. It's so hot. It's so cold. The people are so mean. Like, it's never pleasant outside. It's dirty. It smells. It is... The vibe of Philadelphia is a very occluded energy. It's a very dark energy. So I feel like JP is really just the divine spark within him really recognizes the divine spark within the Mariners. And he's at peace.
Wow. That is so fucking far out. And I love it. Yeah. I mean, it is, it's not how I would have expected him to get to where he is thus far. Like, he hasn't hit a homer. He is OBPing higher than he's slugging.
Yeah, he's walking a lot.
He's walking a ton, which, you know, was always a thing for him. And, like, I mean, if you look at his numbers right now, his numbers look a lot like the numbers he had in, like, 20... is actually very close to, like, his 2015-2016 numbers in the minor leagues, where, you know, essentially he built himself into a top 10 in baseball prospect, and it was like, oh yeah, like, this guy walks a ton. He doesn't strike out much. He doesn't hit for a ton of power, but, like, he's an above-average hitter who... also is an incredible defensive shortstop. And, you know, it took him a while to get here, and it's not for sure that he'll be this way because he had a good start last year and then kind of got tired and fell off. But, I mean, he is just hitting so many, like, spray, not even full spray, but line drives. He's hitting an absolutely just, you know, fabulous. He's doing a really good job of sort of getting his barrel to the ball, even if that doesn't mean he's hitting it all that hard. You know, it is such a encouraging thing after seeing him really struggle a fair bit last year, both and really for the last few years, to both make contact and to, I think, try and get to his power. And this year he seems so much more comfortable, and it's fabulous. I mean, it is an establishing thing if the Mariners have this version of J.P. Crawford going forward.
Yeah, I think that's about as big of a building block as you can ask for, is to have a top-of-the-order foundational shortstop who plays great defense, who can get on base, who does basically everything like an old-school scout would want from a shortstop. Yeah. Like, there are shortstops now who just absolutely destroy the ball. Like, Tatis has 8 home runs already, and like, Crawford's never going to be Tatis. That's okay. If we can have a guy who, you know, has this, what is it, 14% walk rate, that'll probably regress at some point, but like, if he just can continue this approach that's got him to this point, I think that would be wonderful, because you could really make the argument, I know we're only 20 games into a season, but he right now, he's maybe the best shortstop in the American League. I mean, defensively, Fangraphs has him only behind Marcus Semien, who has not hit at all this year. Semien has a 57 WRC plus. J.P. Crawford's is 128.
Wow.
So he's doing both of the things you need to do to play shortstop very well. Like, he's fielding well and he's hitting well. The only thing you could maybe complain about is what John said, the no homers. But I think the other aspects of his offensive game are sort of buoying him enough. You would love to see a better slugging percentage. And again, not to compare him to Tatis, but JP is slugging 366. Tatis is at 711.
Yeah.
Well, which is unreal.
And I mean, really what you're looking at with JP is just, can he continue to be what he's been thus far, hitting the ball not all that hard. And I don't think that there's, I don't think that that's a, you know, a death knell for him by any stretch. You know, there are a lot of guys who have had success just kind of spraying the ball or just hitting a good line drive rate with good pitch selection. You know, and the challenge is typically guys who don't hit the ball that hard or don't threaten pitchers start getting challenged in the zone a lot. But then, you know, but then he's not making bad contact on the balls in the zone. He's just hitting line drives, you know, and they're not necessarily clobbered, but, you know, they're still turning into hits. It's still hurting the other team, you know. And so you, I think it's a really, really promising sort of combination. And he makes for, at least right now, such a great leadoff guy in that he's got that OBP. He's fast enough to steal a base. He's fast enough to, you know, take advantage of better contact. Excuse me, better contact from the guys behind him, or just, you know, trot home on a Kyle Lewis dinger. So
I feel like in a lot of ways, JP has, again, this goes to like him being comfortable and happy on his proper coast again. He's just kind of not worrying about the power as much, and he's kind of gone into, he's leaning more heavily on the skills that made him special as a minor leaguer. Like, his great on-base percentage, he's got a great eye. Not everybody does. So he's going to use that, and he's going to use that to be, I'm looking at his StatCast page now, he's in the 93rd percentile for K percentage. So he's striking out very, very little. He's not whiffing. He's at 96th percentile for whiffs. He's taking a ton of walks. So he's just doing those things, and he's taking what pitchers give him. So yeah, his numbers are not, his power numbers are not great. Like, he doesn't hit the ball hard. He's very low in hard hit, in barrel. But he's top of the, he's absolutely like the little red bars all the way to the right for expected batting average, for WOBA, expected WOBA. So he's maximizing, I think, the skill set that he has, and his numbers, he's actually expected, his expected slugging is 463, while he's only slugging 367. So I think there's even an argument that he could be slugging more. It's just, this is kind of where he's at right now. But to me, it feels like he's more, he's trying to do less at the plate, and that is translating into him getting a lot more.
Yeah, I agree with that. And he's on pace. I mean, if it was a 162 game season, he'd be on pace for about 24 stolen bases too, which is great. So we're seeing it all finally come together, and I think Kate's on to something with the West Coast vibes helping him. It's going to be the new, you know, Ryan Healy could only hit during day games. We got to monitor how JP Crawford does playing west of the Mississippi.
There's like a very clear aura around him now that wasn't there before, I feel. Like, he's just, and he looks so much better in our uniforms. I think that's a huge part of it, too. Very aura enhancing to look good in your threads.
Absolutely. I love the teal sleeves that some of the guys are wearing. Him and Vogelbach have been wearing them. It's a great look. Yeah. Okay. Shout out Dylan Moore. Shout out Kyle Lewis. Other positives of the season, but we have to move to negatives before answering more listener questions. So I wanted to give them some shine without maybe giving them a full segment on the show.
There will be plenty of talk. There will be plenty of talk. There's plenty of talk about Kyle Lewis, and there will be much more talk about Dylan Moore if I have anything to do with it.
Absolutely. But unfortunately, we move from the happy to the crappy, and I think that the thing that's on everyone's mind, the thing that is, I think, the most capital C concerning, if you had to pick a capital C concern in 20 games, is Evan White hasn't hit for shit yet. He's got a 104 batting average, folks, 164 on base percentage, 179 slugging. He has entered what scientists call the Heffernan zone. Do y'all fuck with Bert Heffernan? Do you know who that is?
No.
He's a real guy. He's a real person, I assure you. His name is Bert Heffernan, and despite that name, he actually played for the Mariners in 1992, not 1978.
What? Impossible.
No, I'm serious. Look him up. Burt was very bad. I found him while researching other Mariner rookies who had kind of tough starts to their career. Burt Heffernan only appeared in 8 games, so this is admittedly not a great comparison. But he hit .091 with a .182 slugging percentage as a 27-year-old rookie and was never heard from again. But I did find this great quote from his college coach who said, "There are 3 things that make Heffernan stand out from any other player I've ever seen anywhere." So you're thinking, okay, it's going to be great. 1, he's not afraid of getting dirty. That's like literally anyone can do that, coach. It does not separate Burt from anyone else who's ever slid. But anyway, 2, said his coach, he's not afraid of getting hurt, which is, again, not a real skill for a baseball player. But then his coach says, most importantly, Burt is not afraid of embarrassing himself. He has a good time playing this game. And unfortunately, he just embarrassed himself every time he got up to the plate in the big leagues. And we hope that Evan White does not go full Heffernan. But right now, that's unfortunately a pretty apt player comparison for Evan White, who will surely pan out better than the homie Burt. But
never right go now, it's full pretty bleak. Heffernan.
You cannot imagine how happy I was when I found a guy named Burt Heffernan who played in the 90s. This guy played with Griffey, not with, like, Ty Cobb.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, Evan White, though, I mean, it's going to be negative, folks. I'm sorry, but he leads all of MLB in strikeouts. Right now only has 3 extra base hits, is striking out 42% of the time and walking less than 7%, giving us a WRC plus of, get ready, folks, -3, which, if you're new to numbers, is extremely bad. But we're only 20 games in. He has sort of the privilege and the curse of learning all of this on the job. There's no other option at first base. I mean, I guess they could alternate site him, but that seems like that would do more harm than good, in my opinion. But he is, I think, the one thing, if you were to do your classic, oh, you know, Mariners, they did it again. They found another prospect who can't hit. Like, I hate that mentality, obviously, but if you're doing that for Evan White right now, at least you are statistically correct. I concede you that point.
Yeah, Kate can go into a little more depth. I know Kate and Joe Doyle wrote about some of the specifics on White's struggles, but I do want to sort of highlight just 2 things on him right now. One of which is that he is obviously making just absolutely not enough contact. He's swinging and missing, it looks like about 41% of the time, which is very bad. You would like to see him closer to the MLB average of around 24. So that is obviously just, you know, a huge issue for him. But it's, you know, I mean, it is really, the challenge is just converting the contact he's getting into more hits, because he's absolutely clobbering the ball when he's hitting it, and he's not necessarily getting the
92nd percentile hard hit, 78th percentile exit velocity, 75% barrel when he hits it, which is not often, but when he hits it, he damages it.
He's barely ever sort of just getting a piece, and he's hitting it on the ground too much, which, you know, has been an issue for him at times in his career. But, you know, the components are still there in terms of, you know, this is major league level contact. It's just not happening enough for him. And I think he's, it's converted into him pressing, unfortunately, and over swinging to some degree. You know, and there's no way around it. It sucks to hit. He looks bad. And he's at some points having just bad process. But, you know, there's enough for me to think the better option is to continue letting him work at this. Because,
I mean, he has 4 barrels. You know how many barrels Malik Smith has? Who would like to guess?
Malik Smith has a bat?
Who would like to guess how many barrels Malik Smith has?
I don't think Malik Smith's bat has a barrel.
No, he has zero barrels.
That's what I'm saying.
He's got like one of those like little league bats that's just like super long.
He had 8 barrels last year. Yep.
The Amir Khan from Backyard Baseball.
Exactly.
He had 8 barrels last year. So Evan White is already halfway to Malik's. Anyway, I just want to underscore the fact that, like, yes, the numbers look really bad, and there are a lot of things to be worried about. Specifically, when you see him have a loss of an approach, which he has, like, he has had some really bad at-bats. I wrote about this, but the Dylan Bundy at-bat, and John, you did some analysis, too, of, like, just how he was pulling off his head at the last minute there, like, just not...
Yeah, I mean, he's swinging to try and hit a 5-run homer, and... get himself,
because right now that is the only thing that probably will feel really good to him.
Yeah, you know,
which is okay. I mean, it's natural. It's a natural part of going through this, which, again, in the article, which you should go read if you have not, it's long, but it will explain, you know, this is a really difficult thing he's doing. Very few prospects go straight from AA up to MLB and actually have to stick there all year. And it's usually kind of phenoms. It's the Tatises and the Acuñas and the Confortos and, you know, guys who are kind of Benintendi, guys who are kind of can't miss. And for Evan White, the selling point on him has never really been the bat. The bat is supposed to be average to good, and he does hit the ball hard. It's just, as John was saying, he has a tendency to put it on the ground too much. He's been working on trying to elevate more, but the selling point with him is the defense. The defense is I feel like it's 75 grade, if not 80 grade. Like, it is elite first base defense, and it isn't just him, and, like, none of the defensive measures are going to take this into account right now, because he's going to have a hit for playing at first base, but, like, you know, when you see him run into right field and make a sliding catch in foul territory, when you see him, like, pick a throw, because JP, I love him, very rangy, not always accurate. He and Evan White are a beautiful pairing, because JP can get to the stuff, he just can't always get it over with total accuracy, and Evan White can clean that up on the back end. It's a perfect pairing. You can just see, like, the infielders are making more risky throws. They're going to fire it over there because they know, even if they don't get the out, Evan White will not allow the ball to get past him. It's not going to wind up in the camera well. The guy's not going to wind up on second base, like, so they can take their shot. So... I don't think you can evaluate Evan White without also evaluating the defense and what he brings on that side. And hopefully that is enough to kind of keep him in a good mental space as he's going through this. Because he does, he looks frustrated, and it's really upsetting to watch. But he's not going to get anything out of being at the alternate training site. He's not going to get anything off of hitting off of Logan Gilbert. Like, no, he needs to be facing this major league pitching. He needs to be in there against guys who have good secondary stuff.
And my hope is, frankly, that, I mean, he is, of every player on the roster right now, the guy who's, you know, under contract longest, should expect to be there longest. Like, yes, you know, he's new. He's the newest guy. But, like, this is, you know, it's not like he's going to lose his job, and also, like, it's not like they're going to give up on him or yank him around. I think obviously it's got to be frustrating. You know, he's been, just like so many of these guys, he's been really good his entire life, and suddenly he's terrible.
Yeah, this is literally the first time in his career he's struggled at any significant way.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, he's had, like, rough stretches, but, like, he has been...
It's generally never been this bad. He's never struck out like this. I mean, not in college, not in his first few years in the minors, never.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I guess this is where I think it matters to see if the Mariners, to talk up their sort of mental health and mental toughness and, you know, their ability to put their players in the right sort of headspace to get the most out of themselves. This is where I think you need to see that, you know, where you've got push coming to shove a bit here, right? You've got a guy who should be starting every day if you know, for how much they believe in him and for how little there is behind him, and he's in his own head, and they have to find a way to get him on the right track.
I mean, I don't know if I'm comfortable with saying he's in his own head. Sorry. I don't think we can make any kind of judgment about what Evan White's mental state is. I think we can say he's looked frustrated on some strikeouts.
Sure.
I think we can say it's not been a linear progression where the strikeouts were bad and they've gotten better. Sometimes they've been bad. Sometimes he's had good plate appearances, and then he's followed that good plate appearance up with a bad plate appearance, because learning isn't linear, and human beings aren't linear, and you don't get better like in a perfect upward arc. You know, there's like dips, there's fits and starts. So that's, I think, a little bit of what we're seeing play out.
I agree, but I think it is important for guys when they are struggling so consistently to have that mentality impressed upon them, because, you know, you and I can talk about that, but does it feel that way for him when, you know, when he's going up there and he tries to have good process and it, you know, it leads to the same bad result or another bad result? And then the next time he goes up there with not seemingly a worse process and has, again, a bad result as well. You know, getting to the point where at least the process looks better each time, even if the results don't.
I would like the process to look overall better. But again, like, that's part of learning is, like, not every plate appearance. And we're dealing with such a small number of them, too. Like, not every plate appearance is going to look great.
No.
Yeah, the thing that I was going to say was on the frustration tip that you mentioned. Like, the thing that I've noticed about Evan White when he gets frustrated is a lot of times it's when he knows a fastball is coming, he's sitting fastball, it's right over the plate, it's like 94, belt high, and he just swings through it. Yeah. That's when I've seen him get really frustrated. And I can understand that. Like, that would be frustrating, knowing you, like, having the everything is right except for the part where you hit it. Like, that's got to be maddening. But I also remember saying this exact same thing last year about Dylan Moore, how he would be sitting fastball a lot, get one right over the plate, and swing through it. And he figured it out. I mean, I don't know what happened, but he became Craig Biggio overnight, basically. So we'll see if Evan White can do something similar. But, I mean, again, like, the way out of this is definitely through more reps.
The
not
way
less.
Out is
so,
through.
Yeah. So, Evan White, we're all with you, bud. Keep your chin up, and hopefully in the future we're not talking about how your defense is still the only thing that's keeping you on the team. We have more questions, though. Well, we have questions, I should say. But this one is right along the same lines from Curtis Christensen on Twitter. They brought up the struggle bus. They said, does the struggles of Evan White, who we just talked about, but also Shed Long, Dan Vogelbach, or Malik Smith worry any of you about the future? My personal bias makes it hard for me to be worried about Shed. I just think that Shed will be fine, the way that, like, a parent always thinks their kid will turn out okay. Vogelbach and Malik Smith I am worried about. And Malik Smith, especially, he's become the guy where, like, I loathe every time he's at the plate. Because at least with Vogelbach, it's like, okay, if they hang a pitch, he could hit it to the fucking moon. But with Malik, it's like, if they hang a pitch, maybe he'll get a double instead of an infield single, you know? And that's just not a fun way to watch baseball. I don't want to have a guy in the lineup where he makes me sad to watch. So I am worried about him. But he's also, I think, you know, not a huge part of the future. I know he has, like, a decently long. What's his contract? Oh, he's ARB eligible, ARB 2 next year. He doesn't become an unrestricted free agent until 2023.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll see, but yeah. I'm not banking on Malik being around for ever.
No, I agree with your sort of delineation there. Evan White, concerning, not unexpected that he would struggle, but, you know, wanting to see him improve on that. Vogelbach and Malik, neither of whom need to be guys. You need more from Shed Long. There's a higher chance you need something from Shed Long. And I will say, with Shed, I feel generally all right. I think there's reason to think he'll be all right. I mean, a lot of his numbers look pretty consistent with where he was at last year. He's mostly just running into an issue of he's putting the ball on the ground a little bit too much, but, you know, he's still taking walks. His walk rate's actually up a tick. You know, he's striking out a little more, but not so much that you'd be deeply concerned. He's looked, I would say, a little bit smoother defensively, not gold glove worthy by any stretch. He's sort of Olay'd a couple liners and grounders, but I think he has looked more just like, oh, this is a guy going through the progressions of the start of a season, and he hasn't started super hot, but he'll start catching the ball a little bit further in front of the plate and get some more line drives and get a little more under the ball and use his power. So I feel reasonably comfortable with how Shed is going to shape up.
I'm worried about Shed. Sorry.
Really?
No.
I'm sorry. Okay. I'm a little worried. I mean, he just doesn't. He's not hitting the ball very hard. Like,
he's hitting it. He's got the exact same exit velo as last year, on average, right now.
He's supposed to be. He's supposed to be this little pint-sized powerhouse, right? So that is upsetting. Just his numbers aren't. And I mean, I don't know. Maybe you think that the K percentage isn't concerning. I think a almost 26% K percentage is concerning a little, given his like kind of overall skill set and what you want to see out of him. I want him to be a high on base guy, and like maybe that's just not what he is. But
I mean, he's got a double digit walk rate, right? He's got, I mean, the main issue is, right, he's got a 265 BABIP right now. Last year it was 60 points higher. You know, his OBP is over 80 points above his batting average. So he's just got to have those hits, you know, and he hasn't had the hits, and he hasn't had, as much of the power. And it wasn't like, oh, this is going to be like a, 20-30 homer guy, but it was something where it was like, okay, if you can hit like 260 to 280, you're gonna be an average or better player, and he certainly has not been on that pace right now. But I just see a little bit more positive in terms of, yeah, this is the slow, you know, this is more ebb and flow than bad approach. And maybe that's wrong.
I don't know. Short, weird season, so I'm not trying to hold anything against anyone. But I would say that Shed is maybe higher on my list of concerns than Evan White.
That's fair.
Whoa.
That's fair.
Interesting. Okay. I will just chime in and say that Shed, even though it feels like we've seen him a lot, still has less than 70 MLB games under his belt. So, like, if he had started from opening day last year, you know, that wouldn't even be like, that'd be like half of a season, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's still a lot of time for Shed to figure his stuff out. Yeah, but I agree that it's verging on concern for me, but I think that just time will help him.
I believe his sort of, if you prorated it out, which is not really how it works, he'd be just like a little over a 2-win player over roughly a full season, somewhere like 2 to 2.5 win player. If you sort of gave him like 600 plate appearances, I think he's around like just like 250 or so. And so, you know, if you smooth that all together, that's that's not scintillating, but that's like, you know, this is an average player who's young and continuing to hopefully improve and adjust.
I'll also say I'm sad Perry Hill isn't around to work with Shed, because I feel like that would really help him out.
Mm-hmm. Have you, I do want to know, Kate, have you been encouraged or discouraged or sort of not really felt one way or the other about like the infield outside of Evan White?
Encouraged for sure, but that's mostly being propped up by Seager and JP.
Sure.
The Shed Long part worries me a little.
Yeah.
Let's go to some other young players. We got a question from at Shibboleth with a 0 instead of an O. They have a great question right off the bat. What is happening in Tacoma? ! I thought we would be more in the loop than we have been, but all we hear is Kelenic is really good. What about everyone else? Who is standing out? Who is lagging behind? This is a great question. I only see the videos that beat writers post on Twitter. It's hard to get any like real stats, obviously. So like, I know that Austin Shenton hit one from Tacoma basically all the way back to Seattle. But I don't know if he's been doing well every day, you know? Do you guys have any idea?
I mean, you only get pieces here and there. I have applied for credentials to Tacoma games, which I've not been granted because there are only 7 spots that they have. So with Jen Mueller kind of... Jen Mueller has been there every day and is filing reports. So if you watch the Root broadcasts of the games, you can usually see like a little update. But it is frustrating because it is, you know, kind of piecemeal.
And from the team.
It's from the team. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's not objective.
What are you going to hear from
him? Yeah, it's not objective. So, you know, LJ Newsome is working on a cutter. That is fantastic. I would love to hear anything, literally anything else about that. So it's difficult because, I don't know, not to toot our own horn, but yes, I will toot our own horn. It's difficult when you don't have the full experience of the games, and then you have people who really know baseball and know analyzing baseball, watching them from beginning to end, who are like tracking these players, who have a long history with tracking these players, who are then and that's what we do. Like that's what we do with the They Might Be Mariners and with the Midshipman's Log is I think that's a huge value add on the site. So it's been sad not to have that to follow, because I think you really do have to have a day-to-day kind of thing where you see, like, this is happening, and then you can kind of build a narrative off of it. So we're only seeing the highlights, which is really exciting, because it's super exciting to watch Jared Kelenic hit a baseball all over Tacoma. But it does feel like a very incomplete picture, which, to be fair, I mean, maybe that's the best we can do in this weird little season.
Is there a, do you think there is a, particular schedule? Is there a particular schedule on the intra squads? I couldn't remember if it was 2 a week or 3 a week. Because I remember, you know, we're obviously trying to get that information, like you said, and I will try again at some point to get down there and get inside. But they're only playing a few times a week in terms of live games, so I'm not totally sure. I know they were trying to work that up at some point, just because.
Yeah, and I think media availability is only for the inner squad games. So again, you're not like seeing guys necessarily working on things. And again, those spots are full of the beat writers, so to follow what individual guys are who are actually not at the alternate training site are working on. Jared Bayless is really great. He was the podcast guest a couple weeks ago. Well, we just posted it this week, I think, because of audio issues, but he broke down his whole training regimen and like what he's doing, and I think that is really interesting, and that's obviously, you're not going to get that kind of insight off of every guy, what every guy is doing, but hopefully, like, we're going to work with various players who we have relationships with and try to get something from them about what they're working on, I know LJ Newsom's agent, so we should be able to get something out of him. It's just going to be piecemeal, unfortunately, because there is no overarching structure to the games or to a regular kind of minor league season. So it is going to kind of be catch as catch can.
And finally, a question from at a fish and his chips. Beautiful.
Oh, yes, I recognize that handle. That's a good account.
Yeah. One of our favorites. They said everyone talks about, for good reason, the likes of Kelenic and J-Rod. But even if not brought up, at least they have Tacoma to develop and show off talent, etc. Who are the guys on next levels down that you think will suffer the most from not having minor league season to make their mark? This is a great question and definitely tailor-made for you guys, because I think that's a good point. There are, you know, the single-A, double-A kids who are just kind of hanging out all season. Like, they got to figure out a real plan to not just, you know, move backwards on their development, or at least plateau. Like, you want to have improvement every day. That's the whole point of the minor leagues. And if you're not getting the opportunity to do that against real baseball players, got to imagine it's pretty hard. So who are the guys on the next levels that you think are probably having a difficult time with sort of this lack of structure? Even if they do have a good routine, they're still not playing baseball games every day like they were last year.
Oh, I want to start out by saying that we actually wrote something up on this. There's an article on the site about which minor leaguers specifically were the most negative impacted by not being invited to join the taxi squad. So Penn Murphy is one that really jumps out for me. He was in the Arizona Fall League last year. He had kind of a breakthrough year at Modesto. He's a little bit of an older guy. I was really surprised that they didn't bring him to the alternate training site, at least, because I think he's a very usable bullpen arm. I would put Scott Boches in that category, too. Sort of Ian McKinney, who was just starting to crack the AA level that had kind of hurt him when he was with the Cardinals and wound up with him being released. So I think mostly guys who are pitchers, who are a little bit older, who are kind of fringy candidates. Ray Kerr is maybe another one that I would think of. I think that class of player has been hurt the most by just losing the prospect who's a little bit older, and specifically a pitcher who are losing out on the opportunity to get game reps, show the team what they can do, and, you know, try to elbow their way into a spot on the 40.
Yeah, I'll add on that. You know, I think on the position player side, because I think Kate, you covered a lot of the sort of most apt pitchers. Joe Rizzo is like probably the first or one of the first guys in the position player group who didn't make the cut. I would have to imagine. You know, it's particularly tough for him as like a second baseman, third baseman, first baseman, kind of tweener to get jumped by not just Austin Shenton, but also Tyler Keenan, who was recently drafted, and Caden Polkovich, just drafted. So, you know, that's a tough thing for a guy who is going to be going into his, I want to say, fifth year, maybe sixth year as a pro, getting his sort of first crack at AA next year, theoretically. And that's, you know, I mean, that's just kind of the clock, not that the clock on his career will shorten up, but certainly that his options will be more limited. You know, he's a younger guy as a high school draftee, but still. And then, I mean, really just a lot of the players from the Dominican Academy, just because so few of those guys got, you know, really got, I mean, only Noel V. Marte got called from the Dominican, you know, Academy to be in the taxi squad without having played at a higher level first. And that, you know, that's not unsurprising, but it is like, for those guys, the current setup is very much you play at least a year there in the Dominican, then maybe you come and start you know, an extended spring training. And then once the Arizona League starts going and, you know, short season starts going around June, July, you know, once the draft is gone, then your season starts. So, yeah, I mean, it really slows you down even further. And for a lot of those guys to not get a chance to, you know, prove, okay, I can handle this lower minors stuff. I mean, that is a real demerit. Brian Perez is the other pitcher, the only other pitcher I'd put in that group, who was, like, probably not a guy you would put in the taxi squad, but he was one of the better pitching, you know, under the radar pitching prospects, sort of a pitchability lefty,
yeah,
who has had really good numbers at every level, has been doing good workouts during the...
Well, he's been in Peoria, where, yes, because he's Venezuelan, so the team held the, yeah, Venezuelan prospects in their complex. I would say that another thing that has hurt the DSL kids specifically is that it's not like Jared Bayless, who went to DBU, who can, like, go train at the DBU field, or players who have fields in their hometowns that they can go to. The Dominican fields were not in great shape to begin with. They're horrible now because no one has been maintaining them because of COVID, which really hit that country hard. So these guys just haven't been able, not only are they not getting professional reps of any kind, but they are also not able to just go out and play, like, pickup ball at their local fields. I mean, only recently, I think, have a lot of them returned to meeting up with guys just, like, who are obviously not really on their level, not pro players, in kind of substandard conditions. So they've been doing what they can. Bless Jonathan Classe's heart. He's been just working out like a madman. His biceps are... He looks like the Swole Doge meme. I mean, he's just like a little head.
He does.
And then these enormous, yeah, biceps. Because he's just... I mean, that's what he's been able to do. And he has to do something, so... You know, they're out there hitting into nets that they've made themselves out of, like, old t-shirts.
Yeah.
It's pretty grim, and it's really, unfortunately, much like, you know, kind of any other wealth gap, things that were exacerbated by COVID, you're going to see that, too, in the people who kind of had the least resources are going to be the most adversely impacted by this. Which sucks.
I will say one other name, just real quick, is Sam Carlson, just because, you know, I think he's the person most heavily highlighted in the article you referenced, Kate, but for guys
who... He's playing in an independent league right now, though.
That's true. That's true. Which,
I mean, it's bad for him professionally, but he is, I think, in a... Because of his age, and so I mean, I'm less worried about Sam Carlson, or I feel less That's badly fair. For him, yeah, than I do for some of these other guys.
Certainly. But yeah, it just was, you know, it's, you know, the big thing for him was getting in-game reps, and I'm glad that he's doing that at least. But
yeah, on, yeah, some level.
Yeah, bad for the Carlson, but good for the content. I didn't even know that, though. I learn a lot every time we do this podcast because you guys have much closer tabs on the minors than I do. So, Sam Carlson in your indie league, keep doing
Hello,
you, baby.
Yes, it Hope is all Instagram. Out. It is literally all Instagram.
That makes sense. As long as Jonathan Classe doesn't turn into what's Buddy's name in the Yankees in the Yankees system, who's absolutely
Yasson
too
Dominguez.
Big for his body. Yeah, Yasson. Yeah. If he reaches that level, we have to step in and intervene, but until then, I think just normal swoleness is fine.
I will take a normal cube of muscle. All right. Yeah.
Take what we can get this year, for sure. Thank you to everyone who sent questions. We got a lot. I think the off day really inspired y'all, and it was great to see such fervor in our Twitter comments. So we couldn't get to all of you, but we can always kind of roll these over for next Absolutely. Time if they're still relevant. And continue that enthusiasm and energy when we call for questions in the future, like 10 minutes before we start recording, because that's when we really need it. But as always, thank you for listening. I'm Matthew Robertson, at mroberson22 on Twitter. Kate Prusser and John Troopin were here with me. Their Twitter names are just their names. Kate Prusser and John Troopin, because guess what? They didn't make their Twitters in 2012. Well, maybe you did, John. How long have you been on Twitter? Were you a high school tweeter?
I was not a high school tweeter. I think I got in there. I did have a different handle. I changed it at some point. I was absolutely like Troop Dog on there, and at some point I changed it. It was September 2012. So, oh. Yeah, just after... you know, just early college, start of college there.
Well, we can't all be as brave as I am. That's why I've effortlessly shifted from high school tweeter to professional podcaster. It was true. Really a logical step for someone as brave and, you know, worldly as I am. So you guys get it. The listeners get it. We love you all. Thank you for listening. And until next time.
Bye.
Goodbye. Let go.